This week on Retronauts, play Game Boy and do crimes. Hello, one and all. Welcome to Retronauts. I'm your host for this month, Nadia Oxford. If you recall, last month, I talked about comics that were included with your childhood issues of Nintendo Power. You know, Star Fox, Zelda, Super Metroid, you know, pretty good stuff. So I'm not done talking about childish things. I'm never done. So this month, I decided we're going to be talking a bit about the Valiant Nintendo comics published in the West by Valiant Comics in the early 90s. And this should be a ton of painful fun, I suppose, because this comic does have a few skeletons up its sleeve. But first, I'm going to introduce my two guests. One of my comic book consuming deviant friends here is writer Daniel Cazor. Say hi, Daniel. Tell us what you do.
Hi. From 2010 to 2017, I ran Post Arcade, the video games vertical at the National Post in Canada. Since then, I've been laying low. And by laying low, I mean getting paid work that is not related to video games, because that seems to be the thing that you do these days.
You kind of do. Like I've slunk away from video game writing, but I'm still writing. You just can't find me as easily as you used to be able to. Mm-hmm. I think I remember Post Arcade. I'm sure I read it. So that's really cool.
Yeah. We were both in Toronto and probably going to the same press events, but I don't know that we ever met.
No, I don't think we have, even though your name's kind of familiar. Oh, man. So Toronto's a small city, even though it sprawls everywhere.
Yes, exactly.
And for my second guest, we have my good old friend here, writer, podcaster Matthew Green, who I'm really excited to finally be podcasting with. So say hi, Matt.
Hey there, Nadia. Thanks for having me.
Oh, anytime. I'm really glad to have you here talking about crazy ass comics, like God intended.
Yeah, these comics have a special place in my heart, even though they're just terrible.
I would say that they're like one notch above terrible. They're like terrible adjacent, you know, like they're definitely worse comics than these.
I think we can get into that in just a second. In fact, why don't we talk a little bit about how we got into the comics? Speaking for myself, I did not even know these existed until my husband, like, we got married. He brought over a bunch of weird American stuff, and this was included amongst it, like just a whole collection of the Valiant Mario comics, which include stories about also Zelda. Captain N is a big one. Game Boy, we'll get into that because, oh boy. And there's also like random smatterings of other characters too, like Little Mac. We'll certainly talk about his adventures getting, I don't want to use the word bukkake, but there was a kind of a scene in one of the comics that gave me a terrible vision, but we'll get to that. For now, I guess that's all I can really say about how I got into the comics. How about you, Daniel?
Well, I'm 42 years old. I got these comics new when I was a kid. So my dad and I used to go and get comics every week. Every Friday, we would go to the comic store. And as soon as I saw that these Nintendo comics, Nintendo, something that I absolutely loved, were in the shop, I knew I had to have them. I had to have all of them. And so I started getting them new. And in the back of one of the issues, there was a coupon spelled coop, like Coop. Koopa. And I cut that out of the comic like a heathen. And I sent that in knowing that I would get a discount on the 12 issues of whatever series I was ordering. And I started getting them in the mail, just like my Nintendo Power.
Oh, that's actually now that service. Did you grow up in Toronto?
No, I grew up in Edmonton, which is actually where I live now. It's still in Canada, but not in Toronto.
Are you? I know someone got mad on me at Twitter for saying Edmonton was very cold. And no one wanted to live there because it was very cold. Was that you?
I think it might have been me, but Winnipeg is definitely colder than Edmonton.
Oh, absolutely. It's called Winterpeg for a reason.
And Toronto is not nearly as cold as people in Toronto think it is.
Oh, God, no. I know that. It's just, I'm thank you, Great Lakes, for moderating our temperature. I am good with that. But you guys, so when I was a kid in Toronto, I didn't see too many dedicated comic book stores at that time. But I was probably looking in the wrong spots. I grew up in the north end of the city rather than in downtown. So was there, at your age, when you bought these comics, there was an established store that you got it from?
There was an established store, but also I was not finding these things at nine. My dad, who is a huge comic book fan, who has, you know, dozens and dozens of long boxes down in his basement, now meticulously organized, it definitely was the one who got me into comics and got me reading there.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, because like you said, those were comics that you would not see unless you knew where to look. Like when we were kids on the rack, what did he have? He had Archie. I know Sonic was out a lot, and it's probably what gave him part of his fame. But we'll talk about Sonic some other day, because dear God, Sonic always demands like two back-to-back episodes. Whatever you're talking about with Sonic, it's big.
Speaking of the Sonic comics, though, like these sort of Sonic comics, you read the first five or six issues and you're like, what's going on here? And then they kind of establish their own world and their own continuity, and they get more confident. Yeah. These comics sort of feel like what would have happened if the Sonic comics were not actually allowed to do that. And they're cut off, and they're sort of getting to the point where they might have a confidence, and then they just end.
Yeah, they just kind of drop off the edge of the cliff. That's actually an interesting discussion. But first, Matthew, we should probably introduce you before we crowd you out.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm reminded of the Futurama quote where Mr. President, our people tell the same story about... Well, it sounded funnier in my head when I thought of it. But anyway, my point
I've done that a million times.
Yeah. I was 9 and 10 years old when these comics were first out. And just like Daniel, my father took me down to the local comic book shop to buy them every month. Had to use my allowance money. Took me down to Eric's Baseball Cards and Comics, which was
That sounds so Simpsons. I love it.
Doesn't it? Well, it'd be funny you say that, because the owner was a very comic book guy.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And you go in the store, it's a rat's nest of boxes and back issues and board games on the back and weird art and cardboard standees and trading cards. But on the back wall was this massive rack of all the new comics that month. And over the course of the month, he would rotate them out as new ones came in every week. And the Nintendo ones were always smack in the center on the lowest shelf, perfect for little children to see and grab. I cannot tell you how I found out about them, because I don't remember them being in Nintendo Power at the time. It must have been that cultural playground osmosis that we all had as kids.
One
kid finds out about it and then everybody else knows about it within the week. But I never had enough allowance to buy all of them that came in. And I don't believe Eric ever had them all, because I bought all the Marios I saw. I bought a couple of Zeldas. I have all the Game Boys. I have a handful of Captain N's that I actually bought last year off of eBay. And that was just a nostalgia, hey, let's see what's out there kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I have the hardback best of collection of Super Mario Brothers.
Definitely don't have that.
That's apparently pretty rare, from what I understand.
Yeah, I was actually kind of glancing at the prices they had on eBay, and they're not cheap. Some of them are a little cheaper than others, but they're all like, they can command three figures quite easily.
Really?
Yeah, a few of them can.
I paid $10 for it when it was new.
Good job. You know, it also could be a fact that I was glancing, and that's like what they were asking versus what you're actually going to get paid. I know a lot of people go on eBay saying, hey, I have this piece of junk, it must be worth something, give me $100. And you might get lucky. There was one woman ages ago who sold a bra that fell out of her ceiling. And she just put it on eBay as a quote unquote, this nasty bra that fell out of my ceiling. And it was so compelling that it did go for quite a bit of money. That was pretty funny. These comics were published by Valiant, which was a label that broke off from, I believe, well, back then DC and Marvel were both like, as they are now, titans and greedy and not paying their writers what they deserve. So, it was a spinoff of the big companies and founded in 1989 by Steve Masarki. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. Sorry if it's not. And a former Marvel editor-in-chief, Jim Shooter. Bob Layton, who was known for his work on Iron Man comics, was brought on board as well. You will see their names kind of hidden on the margins of the stories. And it seemed to be a tight team that worked on the whole thing. There were sometimes like names didn't recognize who would come in from the outside probably to do like contract work. But for the most part, these were the guys working on the comics. And this is actually very interesting timing, because Polygon just released an article where Bob Layton talks a little bit about his time in Valiant. And he says, probably the biggest mistake they made in the beginning was grabbing all those licenses, because they also grabbed WWE/WWF. And that must have cost them a lot of money. And by the looks of it, they got a lot of licenses at once, because I know things were a little looser back then in terms of licensing. But nowadays, can you imagine one comic book publisher just coming out of the ether and saying, oh, yeah, we have the rights to Mario, Zelda, Game Boy, Captain N, like everything, and we're just going to be making comics willy-nilly on this. Not something you could get away with these days. I'm not even sure if Nintendo of Japan knew about Valiant Comics doing their thing, because everything was so... communication was just nothing back then. You could send a telegram or something, not a telegram, but like, a courier or a phone call, but back then, it was like, if you wanted to screw around with a property, that was the time to do it because no one was coming to stop you.
There's also the, like, you wouldn't assume that any of the people at Valiant spoke Japanese or that any of the people at Nintendo of Japan. I mean, many of them probably did speak English, but a lot of the people making the decisions probably wouldn't. So it would always be through two or three levels of intermediaries, even if it was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it in the past, but just look at Captain N, which this version of Captain N actually does not have the third party characters because they just couldn't negotiate the rights. So there was someone paying attention. But in the interim, we got a couple of characters. We got Samus Aran, a very, really interesting interpretation of Samus Aran. And yeah, I'll get back to that in a sec. But Valiant, basically, I feel like they published everything at once, then dropped it on the floor and ran because I think they knew that they spent a little bit too much money on this. So the comics did not really have a chance to grow. And I think they had the potential to grow, especially the Zelda stories are generally good. The Metroid stories were good. Mario was always a goofy ass one-off comic, but that's all it really could be. Look at the Mario movie, you know, Mario saves the princess. Hooray, we have $1 billion. So what works, works. But I wouldn't call them terrible. Matt, you call them terrible. What would you justify them being terrible on?
Because even at 9 years old, reading them, I would finish it and go, well, I enjoyed the artwork, but the jokes landed flat a lot of the times. There's a couple of good gags here or there, and I think we'll get to that here in a few minutes based on our pre-show notes.
Yeah.
But yeah, the writing was just pretty poor, and they didn't follow what I thought the character should be doing. And of course, when you're 9 years old, you know exactly what those characters should be doing.
Oh, of course.
And if they're not doing that, then it's just wrong.
No, I totally agree. As someone who, my fanfic origin story was to write Mario and Luigi because I wanted them to swear and fight, and they did. So I completely understand where you're coming from. At the same time, I also understood, okay, I can write Mario and Luigi swearing and fighting. They probably can't do that officially. Like, I had enough sense in my head to know what was realistic and what wasn't. But I do know what you mean about the jokes. And I found the same thing with Super Mario Brothers Super Show. Like, they went over my head when I was a kid. But reading them now, it's kind of like, it's kind of funny. I like that. Like, Mario having a ship named the Spirit of Flatbush. That's pretty funny. Mm-hmm.
And I would also say that I think a lot of the impression for the quality of these comics comes from the Mario ones, which are so similar to the Japanese Mario comics, but just not as good, that it is really hard to kind of not think of them as kind of being, oh, you know, wah, wah, wah. that said, I would say that the comics are in general better than the cartoon shows that they are based off of, the Mario ones and all of the other ones as well.
Yeah, I do notice that some of the art, especially for the Mario ones, is a bit sloppy, but they did not have a lot of references back then, so I have to give them props. Obviously, they use the cartoons. You can see they have like the Princess Deke style kind of combination Koopa wart, which was always a fascinating design. I don't know who, but years ago, someone sent us a perfect, just a beautiful Koopa in that style as a plushie, and we never found out who sent it, and it's just like a great plush, and I love it so much, because to me, that's the Koopa I grew up with. So yeah, I appreciate that they kind of used that for these stories. But as you say, it was a lot of wordplay, a lot of puns. And the thing is, it did try to be as goofy as the Japanese manga Mario comics, but it didn't have the bouncy artwork. And that's really what kind of pulls everything together. What do you think, Matt?
The artwork really felt like it came out of the instruction manuals of the day. And for me, that's a definite plus, because there were two versions of Mario when I was a kid. It was the pixels on the screen and then the artwork in the manuals. So as long as you stuck to one of those styles in your merchandise, you were fine.
Somebody, I think it was you, Matt, well, actually both of you, wrote about how, like, basically the pricing of the magazines here. Now, I don't know a whole lot about how they were priced, so if you want to talk a little bit about that, it'd be great.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that in the beginning, they were all published on this very nice premium cardstock type paper.
I think we have those, yeah.
Yeah, glossy covers.
Yes.
Yeah, and they were $2 a comic, more or less, like $1.95. That was expensive for the day.
Yes.
And then as time went on, they weren't selling very well. They dropped the price down to $1.50 and went down to just your basic paper staples for the binding. They decayed faster. But I look at the ones in my collection, the paper ones are starting to yellow a little bit. Even though they've been in sleeves for 30 years.
Yeah.
But even still, it's cheaper paper. It's cheaper ink. They fade a little bit. They're just not held together as well. But those premium glossy cardstock ones look just as good today as they were the day they were published.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I opened up my box of miscellaneous comics to pull these out, it was very obvious which comics were the Nintendo comics, because they stood out as being much more robust than everything else in that box of comics. And when I pulled them out, I treated these comics like absolute garbage when I was a 9-year-old, and they held up amazingly well, considering how much damage I put them through. The paper is just so much better, and the covers particularly, you could just drop it and ram it into things. I think I walked into a post while reading one. I was so engrossed as a child. And you could see the little fold in the cover, but it mostly hung together.
You can see the blood stain on the cover.
Yeah.
It adds a drama to the scene, to the fighting between Mario and Koopa. Yeah, we have, I think, really felt like they were actually professionally bound. They weren't stapled, as you said, but I think we do have some of the staple ones as well. All of my comics are really buried down there somewhere, but they are on Internet Archive if you want to go ahead and read them. Definitely worth a look. They sure are something. But that I like your walking to the post story. That's pretty good. That's something I would do. See, I was not good at treating my stuff nicely. Getting married, my husband just threw a fit because he goes through my instruction booklets and I wrote swear words on the pages with crayon. And I had two brothers and they did the same thing. And he's like, how could you treat your stuff like this? And it's like, Mr. Only Child, go stand over there. But yeah, I am kind of bad. I actually cut up my Final Fantasy III box for a school project. Yeah, you can't see it here, dear listeners, but Matt just winced. When I think about it, I wince. Oh man, just back then there was no value to it. Oh, if I could only go back in time.
I still have all my old boxes.
Yeah, all of my NES boxes and all of my Super NES boxes. My dad meticulously kept them all in a closet somewhere, and then he gave them to me when I was moving out for the first time, and I just threw them away.
No.
Right. That is the correct reaction. And yeah, now all of those games, if I were to ever sell them, or if I ever wanted to really create a meticulous, collection, they're worth a whole lot less money. So yeah,
unfortunately. Daniel, you wrote here, I'm intrigued. You said that you put in the coupon, as we mentioned earlier, and something about how your dad took the Magnus comics. Now, Magnus was one of the labels of Valiant, wasn't it? Was it a try-hard Liefeld sort of production?
No, the Magnus comics were actually they're kind of old school. Like they kind of felt like the kind of comics you get in the 50s or the 60s, like Prince Valiant kind of things.
Oh yeah.
They weren't bad. I think my dad was just much more interested in that kind of comic than I was at the time.
Okay. Because you wrote, he took the comics. I'm thinking, why were there boobies? Because in the 90s, everyone was drawing boobies.
Yeah. If they had been Bloodspot, I think is the other major Valiant superhero. If they were that, maybe he would have taken them because they were too violent. But I don't think so. Like I was reading Peter David's Incredible Hulk at that time, which is the sort of thing where it's like deep psyche and child abuse and that sort of stuff. And, great stuff for an 11-year-old or a 10 or 11-year-old.
Everyone has their first story like that where they read something way too old for them. And for me, it was Eyes of the Dragon by Stephen King. That warped me a little bit. But yeah, also some points that were also brought up in the notes talking about how the covers and the art were made to really they really did feel like those old Marvel Superman and DC Superman. Please don't kill me. Like those old school comics is what I'm saying. Like at the time, like more action based. They did kind of give the impression of something that's like, hey, kids, here's Superman rescuing the day, except it's Mario or Captain N. It wasn't like manga or something, which has like a very continued deep storyline. These were all one offs. And I wonder. And I wonder if you believe the same thing, if maybe if Zelda in particular had been given time to flourish, if we would have had something a little more substantial in time, even Mario, any of the titles they published, really.
Game Boy was a 4-part series.
Oh, Game Boy is an epic. Game Boy belongs alongside the Odyssey. We're not including Game Boy here.
Well, the Legend of Zelda comics, every book had two stories plus a couple of little like two-page one-offs kind of deals. But there was that one issue where that had the two-part story in one book. So you wound up with like a 22-page story, you know, minus the ads. Mm-hmm. That's a taste of where it could have gone if it hadn't worked to opportunity to develop.
Yeah, and the stories in the last issue of Zelda also, they were two separate stories, but they were linked and they talked to each other. Like events in one story mattered for the events in the other story and vice versa. And so like you could tell that they were putting a level of care into that didn't go into the cartoon show, which if I recall correctly, often had, you know, was done in a very short period of time with a very small group of people. And so, yeah, like I could have seen the Legend of Zelda develop into something. I could have seen Captain N also develop into something. Something is a Metroid comic, though, because they sure like were like, oh, this Samus Aran character has room to grow, can have character arcs. Who cares about the stupid, self-insert Mary Sue Kevin character?
Also, she's a cougar. We're not going to talk about ages. No siree.
Everybody's comics, legal. Come to think of it, there were a lot of stories focused on the dog. Did you notice that?
Right. Duke. Yeah. Duke. That was the dog's name. I always wanted a dog like Duke. And I look at the intro now for Captain N, you see it's like the realistic one. And you can see they just took a yellow lab and painted a black circle over its eye to represent Duke. Poor thing. I am looking at these covers, actually, that one of you put into the document. Thank you for that. And I have to say the Zelda ones are really great. Like, there's this one of Link fighting a Daria, who is the alligator soldiers from Zelda 2. And dear God, they're terrible. And it looks like just as menacing here as it would like in the game come at you with their frickin' axes. Very, very, like, again, action-based covers meant to kind of get the kids in and... it could have matured a little bit more, but it didn't get that chance. And what I always found interesting is that the Zelda comic, Link had a horse. I think in the cartoon he had a horse too. And to this day, I wonder. I don't know if like Japan must have watched by this point, like these cartoons that we had as kids, whether ironically or unironically. And I don't know if that was the inspiration. Of course, a hero has a horse. And maybe there's nothing to it, but I just remember his horse's name was Catherine. Which is such a stupid, weird name for a horse. Epona is much, much better.
I think it's a pretty general idea that you would get to if you were trying to expand what Link was doing.
Yes.
Although Catherine in the States for his horse. In Japan, though, they localized the horse as Birdo, come to think of it.
Are you serious? I didn't know that.
I am not serious.
Oh, I just got that. You just got it, That's pretty good. Thank you.
I should have warned you that I have the power to say things that are totally wrong and they sound real. I've been told that by many people. So.
That's pretty good. That's not at all harmful on the internet. You should use that for a prank. No one will get harmed. I think like a good example of what I was talking about, kind of the dual nature of the comics is, for example, there was a issue of Mario where there was, I don't even know why they invented this, a quote unquote stupid bomb that people would get hit by the bomb and they would turn stupid. Now, this is a very standard, I think, one of those stories that come off a template and someone erases the dryer marker and like fills in, okay, here's Mario, here's Koopa, here's whatever. But there is one great scene where something goes in reverse and a Sniffit becomes brilliant and he emerges from the cloud of smoke with a little mortarboard that you see on professors and he's saying E equals MC squared. And you just have this panel of Koopa looking at the reader and saying, I don't see how this could possibly work out to my advantage. And I just thought that was really funny. You did have your moments. I don't know if you remember any particular yourselves.
I just remember about that issue. It wasn't a stupid bomb. It was the stupid bomb. S-T-O-O-P-I-D.
Stupid.
Yeah. Koopa had a plan to drop these stupid bombs on the Mushroom Kingdom, make everybody stupid. And instead he wound up basically just bombing everybody by accident, including his own people.
Yes.
And that's why he needed the smart bomb to undo it and which he tested on the Sniffit and was like, okay, this is getting out of control. Most of the Mario characters wound up being stupid for that issue. And it was mainly a Koopa story as he tried to figure out how to fix this.
Yeah, yeah. It was actually pretty funny. And I can't remember if this was the case, but did the bomb not even affect the king, who was kind of stupid by default? I remember a joke like that.
Yeah, he was like, I feel fine. Nothing wrong with me.
I'm the smartest man in the room. There was a reboot episode about this whole exact thing. And so I can't. Although I guess this would come first. But that's what I think of. We are helping. We are helping.
I actually found the Mario comics to be the least memorable of all of these. I'm like, oh, I remember this story and I remember this story. And then I realized, no, those were the Japanese ones. Like they were similar, but just they did not imprint in my head the same way that some of the Captain N stories or the Zelda stories or even the Game Boy stories, which it really did.
Mario, even though it's not a very story heavy property, it certainly has the potential to be linked into something that's more interesting to follow, like the Mario manga we were talking about. That has an overarching narrative. The princess is kidnapped. We have to find her. A whole bunch of stupid stuff happens along the way because it's Mario World. That's all you really need. And I think breaking up the Valiant Mario stories into like bite-sized comics kind of doesn't establish the world quite as nicely, and it does make it a little less memorable, even though I'm looking at a panel where I don't even know who did this or why or how they got away with it. Princess Peach is on a pigeon flying carpet from Mario 2, and she's floating to, quote unquote, the Koopa Zone, and she's literally swearing. So there's like, you know, obviously they like censor it, but she's saying, oh, fuck, but she can't say fuck. So they make it like, you know, symbols. But that was the funniest thing because it's so random. This is a story which turns into a punk and turns evil. And now look at me, I'm Princess so-and-so on my motorcycle, vroom, vroom, vroom. But she swears before she even like gets turned into a punk, which makes it funny as hell. And I'm thinking like, it's not exactly like the kind of thing that makes the Sidori rated R or anything like that, but it is the kind of thing where someone from Nintendo, I would think, would look at that and say, what was that? That's one of those. This is an instance I've been through several times where you do something like that because you think you're funny or you think you're clever or you just forget you did it entirely. And then you go back and you read your published work and it's still there and you say, oh, shit, that went through. So maybe it was something like that. Someone thought they were being testing the waters just to be an asshole about it. And they won. Congratulations. Bah, 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 bah.
That Koopa Zone sign on that cloud that the princess passes, that's the payoff to an earlier joke. Because as the carpet she's on takes her higher and higher out of her control, first she goes through the ozone.
That's right.
Then she goes through the oh no zone. And then she winds up at the Koopa Zone. I thought that was funny.
The oh no zone is pretty funny.
Yeah.
And yeah,
it's an oh shit moment, if you will.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Like, she's justified. Don't get me wrong. It's just like, oh, bother. Oh, I'm in so much trouble. Oh, one of you put up a picture of Mario looking really high, and he says, I am Dirk Drainhead. Oh, right. Yes. This was the story where he got hit on the head and he thought he was Dirk Drainhead.
Yes.
As I recall.
His favorite comic book hero in the world of the Mario comics was Dirk Drainhead, a fantastic plumber hero that runs around with a towel for a cape and a plunger for a sword.
Of course.
Of course. And he gets knocked on the head and spends the whole issue thinking he's Dirk Drainhead, and Luigi and Toad have to rein him in and keep him from getting too out of control. But in his stupor of thinking he's the plumber hero, or the other plumber hero, he actually does manage to defeat Koopa and save the day.
Of course. Of course.
Of course, then at the very end, though, he gets to the comic book shop to buy the latest issue of the Dirk Drainhead comic, and they're sold out. Because Koopa bought them all to line his Birdo cages.
Oh, God, the Birdos in cages. Like, that's just so many disturbing implications. I appreciate the wordplay, but when you know what the character is all about, that's kind of weird. Yeah. I see a panel here you put down where Luigi's looking really pissed off at the comic book shop owner. And he's saying, what do you mean you just sold out to the latest Baroness Blue Blood issue? And he's looks like he's about to like shank this poor guy who runs the place. It's like, is that for him or is that for Peach?
That's for Peach. I want to know. Toadstool. Excuse me. It's for Toadstool.
Oh, I'm so. I tend to go back to old localizations, but Toadstool is one of those that they brainwashed me successfully. I guess they caught me just in time. But you're right. In the comics, it's all Toadstool.
I mean, Mario 64 established that her full name is Peach Toadstool. So, you know, both are correct, technically.
Yeah. If you want to be on a first name basis with her, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. That's true. She's always princess, so she'll cut your head off with like a rainbow axe or something. Oh, one character we need to talk about who shows up oftentimes is Stanley the Talking Fish. He kind of reminds me of, didn't the Mario manga have Stanley the Salesman? Was that his name? Or I know he was a character, like a salesman. So that's an interesting parallel.
Is that friendly both... Floyd?
Floyd, I'm sorry. I was thinking it was okay. So no, it's not a weird, it's not a parallel. I was just mixing things up. But it's the kind of same idea. You have a scumbag character who's all like, you know, slimy and annoys everyone. Those are not very good stories because I don't like Stanley the stupid idiot fish.
No.
He has a bow tie though. Go ahead.
I was going to say the best thing to come out of those stories though is that Stanley decides he wants to woo Wendy Koopa.
Yes.
But Stanley is currently dating Big Bertha and she is jealous of this attempted wooage. And poor Wendy gets her ass kicked up and down the ocean in this comic. Mario is trying to save the day and is just kind of caught up in the crossfire. At the end of the story, Mario and Wendy propose a 10-minute truce to go get sodas and talk bad things about Stanley the Talking Fish.
Yeah, okay, I see that here in the panel you put down. That's pretty great. She gets choked out by Big Bertha. Like, well, they shouldn't get eaten. But I do like the panel, just the very idea of Mario and Wendy calling a truce and saying, you know what? This guy's a dick. Let's just talk about how this guy is a dick. Wendy was always my favorite Koopaling because she was the girl, even though she was a real you-know-what to beat the first time I tried to beat her in Mario 3. And I felt kind of betrayed because, like, we're both girls. You shouldn't be mean to me like this.
Another interesting thing about the Mario comics is just the designs and how they kind of evolve over the course of the comics. If you read the first issue, the design of Toad makes him look like a mushroom from Mario 1. And they yes. sort of have that going for the next like issue and a half, I guess. But then it very much becomes the established Toad look that we get in Mario 2, which is sort of still the Toad look today, a variation of it. But it is very weird how they were kind of off book for that first issue. And clearly they were paying attention enough to get on book. Yeah. But in a lot of these places, it feels like they were given no oversight whatsoever. So it's interesting what did and didn't get affected by that.
There's a story called The Legend that just sets up the storyline from the original NES game. If you're totally unfamiliar with these characters, this will get you caught up. And that's where you can see this off-model Toad a lot. He's all over that one.
Yeah, I kind of noticed, like, again, I was talking about how the early media, supplementary media that we had in the West for these video games and whatnot, like, the design documents just were not there. And that's why we have a Captain N with Simon the way he looks and Mega Man the way he looks, because everyone had to kind of eyeball the screen and see where they were going. So I wonder if there is that really confusing story that people still quote from Super Mario Brothers 1 in the instruction booklet about how the mushrooms were turned into different things. So maybe they kind of seized upon that point, like mushrooms are simple people turned into objects. Therefore, the things that come out of blocks, those are the subjects of the Mario Kingdom. And I guess Mario eats them on occasion. We'll talk about that. And I did notice, like, in the first couple of issues, they're kind of naked. They're just people with like stalks for bodies and weird spindly hands and feet. But I'm looking at one of the later issues here where it's called Betrayal Most Proper. And that involves Wooster, who is the retainer to the king in this comic series. And yeah, I remember him being naked and scary in the first early part of the story. But he has clothes in this story now. He's very dignified. And I think this is an issue where he just walks away from the king because the king is such an idiot and he's had it.
Yeah, he goes to work for Bowser.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Something interesting here that I either forgot or did not know. Wart showed up
one time
in one of the comics.
One time. Story called Cloud Nine,
yeah,
where Wart poses as a mattress salesman and sells the king a booby trap bed that will abduct him when he goes to sleep on it.
Okay.
And sure. Mario and Luigi remark that Wart kidnapped the king again, which implies that this happens a lot and we just don't ever see it.
It's so dull. We just keep it off screen.
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting because Wart like the version they have of King Koopa himself is that mix of Wart and Koopa, since the way I hear it, they didn't really know what they were looking at in terms of who the villain was going to be for the animated show. So they made him a Wart Koopa baby.
I mean, the only way you'd know that this is Wart is one, they call him by name. And two, the character design is the same as Koopa, but he's wearing a like a purple capey robe thing that was out of the video game from Mario 2. So if you're familiar with the source material, I guess you can make the connection.
Yeah, yeah. Easy enough. But Wart's a very, very underutilized villain. I would like to see him come back in some capacity.
I do like how his scheme involved around sleep, though.
That is, see, that's good canon. That's good use of canon, because yes, Wart does rule the land of nightmares. So good job. You know, they didn't hate this comic. I mean, it was a paycheck and it nearly ruined them too, but they did care enough to make it entertaining, at least mildly.
Mildly.
Let's talk a little bit about Captain N and how it differs from Mario, because it does quite substantially. First of all, do either of you watch the Captain N show growing up?
Oh, religiously.
Yeah, I'm almost certain that I saw every single episode, and with, you know, creepy chain smoker Mega Man and giant chin Simon Belmont, but I couldn't tell you the plot of a single episode, unfortunately.
They had episodes where they tried to follow the games and it just turned weird. Like, I remember there were interesting like stories based around Dragon Warrior, which nobody played, even though they really tried to shove the game down everyone's throat and only idiots like myself picked it up. But yeah, just they had to do what they could, because again, these are shows without any kinds of references. So what they did with Dragon Quest is like they just made like this land of dragons and their dragon lord was in charge and he was being mean to all the other dragons. And it's like, oh, this isn't the game plot, but it's cool enough. So it had its competent episodes and also had its episodes, capital E episodes. And it had Mother Brain, to be fair. It was Audrey 2, Audrey 3, if you like.
Yeah, I remember
Mother Brain. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying there are episodes with games like Bayou Billy and Puss in Boots, and you wonder who was clamoring for this one.
Yeah, the Puss in Boots one confused the hell out of me, because I'm like, who the hell played Puss in Boots? And I would imagine it was hugely popular in Japan because they love Puss in Boots over there.
Yeah.
Toy and all that.
Yeah. I always assume when it's a weird game that is featured in any of these, that money was exchanged at some point. I mean, I don't know, but I just assume, you know. No.
You're absolutely right. I remember the Bayou Billy episode was infamous because it was missing a background at points. Just background quit, went home, took five. And they were just standing in a beige void. And they drew a really strange Bayou Billy. I never played Bayou Billy, so I wasn't exactly a fan of the episodes where I didn't play the game and didn't know about it. But I sat there and ate it all because that's what a good consumer does.
Yeah, there's one episode of the show called When Mother Brain Rules. That supposedly nobody at Deke or NBC has any knowledge of where it came from.
Uh-huh.
But you would hope that one of them would know since they developed and broadcast it.
That sounds like creepypasta stuff right there.
It does. It's a clip show.
Yeah.
It just has clips of the of other episodes without the dialogue. So it's characters just, you know, just moving their mouths. And there's a narrator guy that's like, meanwhile, Mother Brain sent the eggplant wizard over to the castle to try and steal the source of power. It's like, who's this guy? Why is he narrating? And how come these clips are all just random order stuff? No one knows where that came from.
That is so weird. I've never heard of that.
It's not on the DVD.
Right.
But you can find it. I'm sure it's on YouTube still. It was years ago. It's got a
I'm going to look for that. Daniel, have you ever heard of that? Am I like out of the loop here?
I've never heard of that. That sounds like something that a distributor was like, we need this many episodes for it to count for our syndication deal. And they just made one out of clips. And, you know, the guy from the mailroom did a voiceover to make it make sense.
Oh, shit. They need me. He's just stuffing the last of his mail into some hole. OK. Meanwhile, at the Palace of Power. That's really interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. So, yeah, Captain N in the comics, as we said before, he did not have the third party characters with him. No Mega Man, no Simon, thank God. And no Kid Icarus. So in their places.
No, he had Kid Icarus.
Kid Icarus
was
there.
I'm sorry. Yes, we did have Pit. That's right. That is Nintendo. Nintendo, please release Kid Icarus Uprising.
His name was not Pit in the comics. His name was
not Pit. That's right. It was Kid Icarus. That confuses the hell out of me to this day. I still vary between the two.
We're lucky that Belmont wasn't just named Mr. Castlevania.
I remember watching the Castlevania 3 episode and being like, this is one of my favorite games. What are you doing? What is going on here? I did like how they made mention of the Poltergeist King, though. That's some deep canon that I appreciate. But yeah, in the place of these third party characters, of course, we had Samus. I'm trying to remember if beyond Samus and her friends and enemies, there was anything else that replaced like Mega Man and the like.
There was another henchman from Mother Brain who was one of the Kid Icarus gods.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blanking on his name.
Yeah.
He came from Kid Icarus. He was one of the, he wasn't a monster. He was a barbarian guy.
Hmm. I don't remember him for some reason. I guess he wasn't very memorable.
He wasn't in many issues, but he was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Kid Icarus guy was not in many issues because I think really early on, they seemed to go, oh, Captain N kind of sucks. Let's make a Metroid comic.
That was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have ever seen, but a while back, somebody put up concept art of what Deke wanted to do. I think it was Deke for further cartoons based on Nintendo properties. And he had Metroid. And it was some dude, of course, just like some space marine looking ass dude firing on an alien. It's like, OK, well, you missed the point. Thanks. Congratulations. Never happened, of course. But we did get, honestly, the best part of the comic was Samus. I'm not going to lie. I really like this interpretation of Samus. Samus in Captain N, she's greedy. She's a bounty hunter. She's out there for money. And again, Captain, she wants, you know, Captain N's ass, but we're not going to go too far into that. She does literally want him to be his like space king so they can rule the galaxy together. But yeah, she's drawn really nicely. And one of you, I think it was you, Daniel, put down the first instance that we have of blonde Samus. I think you might be right.
Yeah, I can't find one before this. This was 1990. So I can't think of one that would have been before this. All of the official Nintendo art of her not in her suit was from that Metroid 1 ending. Right. And there, the color of her hair is defined by the sprite palette of whatever else she's wearing, whether it's a swimsuit or her armor. Yeah. And it's never blonde. It's always light brown to green.
Yeah,
but yeah, here we have blonde Samus, and blonde Samus is what we get after this pretty much consistently. You know, some of the Nintendo Power comics have her like light brown hair, but no, it's pretty much consistently blonde after this.
There is a cover for a Captain N comic where we have, I think Kevin was ruling over the planet of trash in some alternate dimension, and Samus ends up there, and he's just like bullying the shit out of robots and just living like a king on top of his pile of garbage. And he's wearing thigh boots that go way up to his groin. And it's not a bad look other than the thigh boots. I don't know what's going on with those. But Samus, who joins him because, oh, awesome, we get to be trash monarchs together. She has a really fetching outfit. Like, it's green, fits her really well. She has these amazing boots. She's like, wow, I want those boots. So that's probably one of the more compelling stories. One of the weirder stories for sure, because it was trying really hard to be post-apocalyptic, like Mad Max, garbage planet, Captain N, Captain Planet. I don't know.
That was the time portal one, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So sorry, excited editor. To talk about comics.
Yeah. This is like the best story that they had, though. I can see why it's worth getting excited over. Did you want to cover it or should I?
Oh, go ahead.
Oh.
You probably know all the dirty details.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Yeah, Kevin falls into a time portal. And Samus goes in after him. It's now 15 years later. Kevin's been there for 15 years on the garbage planet. And he's become this Mad Max thigh boot guy ruling over everything.
Yes. But
the catch is that now he's interested in Samus. He's ready to be her space king.
Oh, that's right. She aged.
Yeah, because now he's older and wiser and has forgotten about Princess Lana and is ready to move on. And he's like, hey, Samus, great. Let's go. Let's, you know, be king and queen of the trash world. And she is just all over this and is ready to go for it. And then she thinks, no, this isn't right. And also, we need to get back to the status quo of the book. So she winds up like shoving him back through the portal and undoing it. And everything resets to the moment Kevin disappeared originally. So that story in the end never happened. But she still remembers.
She still remembers. That's right. Yeah. Like a single tear running down the cheek kind of thing. Yes. Going on there. That is the kind of story that, as silly as it was, if it had been given a proper arc, that's the kind of thing that would have like carried the series forward a little bit. I think they had a good thing going with Metroid, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like if Kevin had become sort of a secondary character and not like sucked in. Like you redid his backstory so he wasn't literally a self-insert character for the kind of kid who would be reading the book. Yeah. Like I could see it being an interesting Metroid comic. Because as you said, this is one of the most interesting takes on Samus. It gives her like there's definitely room to tell stories with the sort of ambiguous character that she is here. And they didn't get room to do that.
No. And let's not forget, there was another great issue with her where she goes to jail. She just gets trialed by this Pink Floyd kangaroo court and gets thrown into jail. Oh, the judge is Ridley, so you know that's going to go well. Ridley is an interesting design in this comic because, again, nothing in the way of concept art. So they made him this weird kind of bug-looking thing instead of a big dragon we know today. Kind of more alien in that respect. I appreciate the look, but he looks very silly in this comic with like his gavel and like just kind of like had his feet up on the, all right, you're going to jail. And it's like, don't, this mockery of justice, spare me, and the whole thing. But they do end up in jail, her and Lana. And of course, Samus is like 10 feet tall. So she's like saying to Lana, hey, stick with me, I'll protect you. And it was just a really, it was a good story. Cause I remember like Samus just like breaks up a fight between prisoners and says, no, you got to redirect your energy towards the establishment. That's who you need to be angry at. And I'm trying to remember how they got out. I think there was a prison break, but they actually reformed this jail where there was like people being beaten and starved and stuff. And they made it into an actual like facility meant for rehabilitation. That was pretty good. That was someone who had an idea in their head and said, you know what? I don't know what else to do with this idea. I'm going to put Samus and Lana into it and get my paycheck because otherwise it's just going to go to waste. That's the kind of thing I do in my head a lot. Matt, do you remember that story? Do you have any additional like cool insight into it?
I don't remember that one that well.
Really?
No.
It was a good story. It's definitely one of the ones I have.
I remember the one where there's another Captain N, a more futuristic looking guy that shows up that is wearing like a proper power suit that's all like Tron lines and like a superhero take on the Captain N idea. And he's better than Kevin in every way.
Of course.
And he's going to be the new Captain. And Kevin, you can go home and retire because I'm here now and I'll take the princess and save the day. And you can just go. And of course, it turns out that he's a created plant by Mother Brain, one of her plots. And in the end, it turns out that, of course, he's evil and they expose him and destroy him and back to the status quo at the end. But it had some pretty cool images because the cover for that one is the superhero Tron line Captain N shooting Kevin with his own zapper, like you're telling him that you're obsolete now.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, that it looks like something cool out of a regular superhero book of the day.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what they went for with their comics for sure. Did Samus get horny for him? Because she seems to have a lot in these comics.
I don't remember her being in that one.
I don't think she was in that issue. The one issue that she was not in and sort of the lead character in.
Oh, gee, she should have been there. She would have loved having two Kevins.
She would have been like, oh, man, it's my birthday.
Probably why she wasn't there.
Well, she did have her own story where she goes up against a hunter who was actually designed after one of the characters. Sorry, one of the enemies from the game. I don't remember what it was called, but it had like the big arms. I remember the character's name was Big Time. And I just liked his design. I thought that was funny. And Big Time kind of turns on her because there's a bounty on Samus's head. Because of course there is. That was just a fun little kind of what Samus does when she's alone kind of story. Like especially when money's involved, it's fun to see a female character be allowed to be greedy. I like that when that's allowed to happen. Go ahead.
I was going to say before we move off of Captain N, I do want to say just both in the cartoon and in the comic, the design of Mother Brain is really creepy. Like,
isn't it though?
Like she looks like she's going to eat your face. Like that was definitely like as a kid, I was like, what's going on there?
And the combination of the voice as well. Like I already was very familiar with Little Shop of Horrors at that age. But you're right. Usually the redesigns they have for these characters, they're not always great. Like for Captain N and the stories and whatnot. But yeah, I think they did a good job with Mother Brain. Mother Brain in the original game, she's just a tank with a brain and not a whole lot going on there. So I like how there's something very Japanese about her design. Like we all know by this point, a lot of Japanese studios were involved with, you know, designing this, the quote unquote American cartoons we grew up with. But she has a mouth, like a big red mouth full of these really human, unsettlingly human teeth. And when she opens her mouth to talk, there's nothing behind her. She has no throat, no esophagus, know nothing. But you're right, she looks like she would bite your face off and somehow eat it. So moving on then from Mother Brain's mouthless maw, however that works, we have The Legend of Zelda. And we talked a little bit about this already because it was a really well, you know, pretty well done in the terms of the compared to the other comics, especially Mario. Basically, as someone wrote here, I think that was you, Matt, they took the treatment of Legend of Zelda that the cartoon gave the game and kind of made more out of it. And I see where you're coming from, because if I recall, they even went ahead and explained like, OK, hello, here's our hero Link. He grew up here. He's an apple farmer. I think he was an apple farmer in these comics. And he gets tied up into his destiny. And that's the way it goes with Link, if I'm correct in that assessment, if that's how it happened.
Yeah, there were maps in the back pages of the book. Like, here's the map of Hyrule, and it's based off of Zelda 2. Here's the map of the North Palace and everything inside the North Palace, where you find the shops. And here's what the throne room is. And it was all very detailed. They did their world building on this one.
They did. I think the again, like I said, the creators all kind of seem to share the duties. Like, I don't think anyone was specific to one book, but I feel like they had a little more fun with Zelda and felt like they had more to work with, which of course they did. I remember they actually did some really nice designs with what they had from the sprites. Like, they pretty much nailed the Lynels. Nintendo makes them a lot beefier and a lot more frightening, but yeah, they made them a pretty serious force. And I mentioned the Darias. I like the way they drew those. Yeah, they did a pretty good job. And most memorable story, according to the notes here, the power and the price, or the one where Link is able to steal the Triforce of Power and uses it to defeat Ganon, but it starts corrupting him and changing his face pig-like. It's kind of like a Galadriel vibes there, like, I will become a mighty queen, all shall love me in despair. So he throws away the Triforce of Power and restored to normal after discarding it. You probably shouldn't leave a Triforce lying around, dude. I know you're in trouble, but...
Well, he threw it down a bottomless pit and Ganon dived down after it.
Cool.
Yeah, I like that bottomless pit is something that from my childhood, like, I remember that burrowing into my brain and it being like nightmare fuel. It's sort of like, well, if it's bottomless, you could just fall forever. You'd die of starvation on the way down. And like, I don't know why that aspect of the story just knifed into my brain, but it was a very evocative story in general. Like, I when we were putting together these notes, both of us were very much honed in on this story and said, hey, this is the one you remember. It's such a good story that a lot of people I hear talk about this and they think it comes from the cartoon itself, but it doesn't. It is definitely just here in the comics.
Now, the comics use the cartoon design, so maybe that's where some of the crossover comes from. But it's all building to the moment where Link has started wearing a Ganon-type cloak when he gets corrupted with power. And you never get to see his face. You just see that, like, that brown shock of hair sticking out the top. And then his face is cloaked in darkness. And eventually, Zelda tells him that, you know, you don't need to team up with Ganon. You've become Ganon. And Link tosses the cloak off and looks in the mirror, and he's somewhere in between Link and Ganon. He's got the pig features, the nose, the tusks, the big ears, the sharp teeth. And that's when he realizes he's gone too far and has to get rid of the Triforce. But that's the shocking reveal that the whole thing is building up to.
He also has a red hand, or is that just a comic, an artist decision?
The red hand is where he originally grabbed the Triforce and it burns his hand.
Cool.
And that's like his Triforce handling hand now.
It can take the power. It's kind of like the Minato. Like, Dunmen can take the power, but he's the only human who can do it, besides Shulk, of course. But he has a damaged arm or hand forever, and that's the only way he can wield it. That's pretty cool. I like that kind of thing. And I also like the point that this story came up before we kind of had the story about the Golden Land and the corruption and all that stuff and changing form in the Dark World. So that's a nice foresight there. Kind of like the horse. Good stuff. And yeah, I'm looking at the map of Hyrule that they put into the book. And you just know someone on the team is like, I love maps. I'm drawing a map. Go to hell. And they drew a map. And it's a good map.
A very detailed map. Like, the kind of art that you put into that map, that really goes over like castle by castle, palace by palace, and has a lot of detail in it. The tender love and care put into that is way higher than every other page of art in the Zelda book. And the Zelda book already had sort of a higher grade of art than most of the other books. So you could tell that somebody was like, I'm going to spend, I don't care if you're paying me, you know, $70 a page, or probably maybe even less than that. I'm going to spend 2 weeks on this.
No, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just kind of putting it out there too, a little bit off topic. I think we have not been north of Death Mountain since, and it's about time we go north of Death Mountain again, Nintendo. Mm-hmm. I love Tears of the Kingdom. I love Breath of the Wild, but please, I want to have Death Mountain to the south of me again and suffer as I try to go through that maze.
Yeah, you can see that landmass in Tears of the Kingdom and Breath of the Wild, but you just can't go there. You know, there's mountains, there's fields, but you know, not you.
Not you. They're not for you. Maybe someday. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you wanted to add about Zelda before we move on to the meat, I suppose, the main course of this thing?
I'm good.
Zelda, forever. Speak now or forever rest your peace.
Just as you said earlier in the episode, this is the one that felt like it could have had the 200 issue Archie comic, like the Ninja Turtles or Sonic, where all of this lore got expanded in a huge way and there were deep characters and all that. And it just doesn't. It ends after, you know, a handful of issues instead.
Like, I think this is the comic that really feels like its own thing. Mario is Mario, but the jokes can work in any context for the most part. Zelda, they really put effort into the enemies, the lore, the setting. I would have liked to see that expand someday. So that's the way it goes, I suppose. In the meantime, we got Game Boy. We got the Game Boy comic. Do one of you gentlemen want to rattle off about this one? Because it seems like there's a story behind it.
I'll start off by really setting the table. It is really hard to overstate how weird this comic is.
It really is.
Deeply, deeply bizarre. And I knew that it was deeply bizarre when I was reading it at 9 years old. Yes. And like everybody could tell how weird it was. And I just like that is sort of the baseline understanding that you have to go into with the Game Boy comic.
Game Boy was written by George Karagane, who unfortunately met his death. He committed suicide not too long after that, a few years, if I'm not mistaken. I had heard that the Game Boy comic was the last thing he wrote, and it was kind of, no, it wasn't the last thing he wrote.
It wasn't the last thing he wrote. After he did the Game Boy comic, he went on to found Penthouse Comics.
Oh, that was after. Okay.
Yeah. And the Penthouse comics, a lot of his friends basically said that working for Penthouse set him onto a dark path, drugs, etc. And that was part of his downfall.
That's really too bad because I mean, he was an incredible writer. Even though the Game Boy comics are weird, you're not going to forget them. Like they're probably the most memorable thing.
Not at all.
I mean, the panel I'm looking at where the guy, there's a kid who's playing his Game Boy. I finished level one, two doors, no, three. And like, there's a mysterious door appears in his game and Mario jumps out. And this kid just looks like he dropped like the worst LSD of his life. And he didn't like, it's the kind of thing you should trip along to. Otherwise, you're in a lot of trouble. He's not tripping along to this. He's really scared. And Mario's just really having a good time. He's like, hey, I'm here to defeat Tatanga. Where's Tatanga? And of course, the guy's like, "Durr."
So go ahead.
Oh, you go say ahead.
The main character of the Game Boy comic though is not Mario, even though he's in every issue. It's Herman Smirch.
That's right. Yeah.
You want to talk about Herman Smirch for a minute?
Please, let's talk about this middle-aged man who hates children.
Yeah, I don't know why they thought this was a guy to build a comic around. basically, he's a middle-aged guy that is just a complete creep that. Mm-hmm. Apparently he steals a Game Boy. He's hypnotized by the Super Mario Land game because Tatanga is trying to cross over to the regular world. And he brainwashes Smirch into committing crimes and trying to kill Mario.
Yeah. But the thing is, does he really need to brainwash him? Because Smirch is a really bad person to begin with. Like, the way that we're introduced to Herman is that he bumps into someone on the street who's asking him for change. Then he, direct quote, says, "Beggars should be shot."
Damn, son.
Then he spends the next full page and a half of the comic complaining about how society is going to hell and how he almost got mugged. And he's complaining about this to his boss at like the Radio Shack knockoff shop that he's working at. And then sort of offhandedly, we find out that, oh, he got his Game Boy because he stole it from the shop and his good-natured boss, who seems to be actually a nice guy. Yeah. And like, that is how we are introduced to this guy, and he doesn't get better. It's wild.
And as the stories go on, though, he is still affected by Tatanga's magic. So when we see him in the second issue, he's all disheveled and has 5 o'clock shadow. He's sweating. His hair is a mess. It's like he's haunted by Super Mario. Yeah.
I guess he's such a bad person so that we don't feel bad that all these bad things happen to him. But like, he's such a bad person.
And if you had any sympathy for him at all, it's gone when he smacks Mario with a lunchroom tray.
That's right. And the sound effect is spang.
Yep.
You don't forget a thing like that. It's a good, perfect sound effect. But yeah, he's just a miserable so-and-so. And I almost feel like, God bless Karagane. I think he was trying to tell something deeper here. And he kind of succeeded in a way, because in my view, it's a story about a man who's so miserable that he has no control over his life, that when he realizes he can sink even lower, he realizes, I have to stop or I'm going to be lost to God's light forever. And he does kind of reach that point where, first of all, Tatanga, he could step on Tatanga if he wanted to. He could step on Mario if he wanted to. Everyone's tiny. Tatanga's always toying around Daisy and trying to, Princess Daisy, and being like, oh, my love, will you marry me now? I captured the world for you. And Daisy's probably like, what the hell? Why did you capture these giant creeps? What is going on? Take me home. And yeah, he does have a change of heart, and it has something to do with space. The cover is actually an empty spacesuit with Mario floating around it, looking like he's having the time of his life. And yeah, Daniel just kind of showed it to me. That is absolutely the cover. But I can't remember why he changed his mind. I don't know if either of you remember.
It's been a long time. It probably has something to do with the, seeing that there's so much more out there. One of those, eye-opening, my God, it's full of stars moments would be my guess.
I'd be happy if he sacrificed himself, but I don't think he did that. I think everybody came home safe at the end.
Yeah, I don't remember him dying.
That was only the second issue, and there were two more issues. One where Mario fought a fighter jet, or was not fighting a fighter jet, but was flying alongside one. And one where Mario was doing a plumbing on a nuclear power plant, and then fainted due to radiation poisoning.
No.
And yeah. And was lying in a puddle of toxic waste before he was picked out. And he was fine. He was fine later.
Chernobyl and this sort Mario. Of gets into...
Yeah, this sort of gets into this. Mario is also a weird Mario, too, right? This isn't the Mario from the Super Mario Brothers comic. This is the Mario that lives in your Game Boy and comes out of your Game Boy and has no point of reference other than Super Mario Land, which is the only Game Boy game that really is referenced in any way in the Game Boy comic.
Right. Yeah, if you want to get Mario out of your game at the end of the level where there's two doors, one that goes to the next level, one that goes to the bonus round, in the comic book, there's a middle door. And if you take him through the middle door, he'll pop out of your Game Boy and save the day.
Oh, boy, Mario, do my laundry. Take the Meeseeks from from Rick and Morty. do my laundry and you can get back to your Game Boy. Why did you bring your friends? Tatanga starts swarming out. But they do eventually say that you're absolutely right about that, Daniel. Never even thought about that. But whereas Mario in the other comics is kind of like loose and fun and, slapstick and cartoony, this Mario is very serious, like very Mario, Mario, Mario. He is, as you say, he came out of the Game Boy to save the day, I guess to rescue Daisy as well. And it's almost like he doesn't know or forgot his other friends existed. And that kind of stuff was always a little bit creepy to me. Is he an alternate dimension, Mario? Did he just forget? Does he have amnesia? This is the kind of thing that churns through my head when you're 8 years old. don't have anything better to do.
I mean, I would take a read on it that in Mario Land, there is no Luigi or Toadstool or anybody else in the other game. So, of course, this instance of Mario would not know them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's the adult explanation. When you're a kid, you just want the fun, stupid explanation. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Because an adult who thinks rationally most of the time is like, well, you know, these characters aren't in Game Boy, so why should we have them in the cartoon or the comic? That makes sense. And they did the same thing with the Mega Man Ruby Spears series, where it's like, okay, well, in that series, in Mega Man 5, we think Proto Man's a bad guy, therefore he's going to be the bad guy for Dr. Wily. And it's just, yeah, it makes sense, but it's not as much fun as it could be. So Game Boy, as we have all determined, is very strange, but it tried very hard to tell us something a little deeper. Don't do drugs. That's the message. Before we go, let's talk a little bit about Little Mac. He's little, so we'll talk a little bit about him. I love Little Mac. He's always been one of my favorite characters. Like, if you look in Punch-Out, if you really pay attention, he jumps up and like to hit the big guys. And as someone who's 5 feet tall, you know, I just respect the hell out of that. So I was glad to see he had a couple of dramatic comics in these Valiant comics. Only a couple of stories, though. The one I remember vividly is, and I made the Bukkake reference earlier, the very unfortunate Bukkake reference. There's a story called The Hunt or The Fox and the Hound or something of that degree where, I don't even remember why, but Little Mac was let loose in the streets and he was going to have people like chase him and punch the shit out of him. And I don't remember the motivation, but it happened. And there's a scene where he gets overwhelmed and just he has all these guys punching. And I'm like, you know, I had thoughts and I thought that was funny, but they were OK stories, like very, you know, Rocky Balboa Doc. You can just picture him, you know, talking like, hey, get out of there, kid, get there. What did you guys think of it? I don't know if you were big Punch Out fans or not.
Join the Nintendo Fun Club today, Mac.
Oh, there you go. That's the only thing he needs to say. That's all that matters.
Yeah. As a kid, I skipped over those comics. I wasn't really a Punch Out fan. And they only appeared in the Nintendo Comic System comic book, which was a grab bag hodgepodge reprinting of other stories from Mario, Zelda, Captain N.
Right.
And there were a couple of originals like the Punch-Out ones that were just dropped in there because they had nowhere else to go.
Little Mac was homeless.
Yes.
I remember those Nintendo Comic System ones feeling like a ripoff as a kid because you would get them and they actually, I think they, in fact, many of them cost more than a regular issue. They were larger, but you get them and it's like, oh, I already own this issue of Super Mario Brothers. The story is reprinted there. And I think I maybe got one of them and I didn't get the one with Little Mac in it. And whenever I was like looking at Little Mac stuff at that point, I would be like, where's Mike Tyson? You know, no Mike Tyson. It's not real.
Oh my God. That's so perfect. I love that. Where is Mike Tyson? Come on guys, pay for it. Pay your license. Let's do this. They should have had like, just make another dude and call him like Mike Blyson or something. I was like, I'm the brother of that other guy. And I also want to kick your ass, Little Mac.
Yeah, or Mr. Dream, I guess, would have been the off-brand Mike Tyson that they replaced him with. But
by then they had Mr. Dream, too, didn't they?
Yeah. Most likely. It was the 90s.
When they re-released Punch-Out or reprinted it, they did it with Mr. Dream because they realized Mike Tyson was already doing bad stuff at that point, even though he hadn't done his really bad stuff at that point. So
yeah, he was kind of like he was a little bit controversial as the 90s went on. Mm-hmm. And one thing I always found very interesting, this is slightly off topic as well, but until Smash revealed Little Mac, I had no idea that Japan just never grew up with nostalgia for Punch-Out, which makes sense because I guess, you know, Mike Tyson doesn't have the same weight over there as it does here. But here it was like, wow, Mike Tyson, he's the greatest wrestler. He's the greatest boxer of all time. And everyone had the game because the name was there and we all grew up with it. But no, when Little Mac was revealed as in Smash, I remember vividly people from Japan saying, who is this guy? Oh, I get it. Americans know him, but we don't know him very well. And that was a really interesting twist because until that point, Nintendo could be very Japan centric and wouldn't really cater to the West as often. So that was a little bit of education for me. Little Mac, the ambassador of goodwill, I suppose, and getting his ass.
Little Mac is the fire emblem of America, I guess.
yes, yes. We learned each other's cultures through Smash. Mm-hmm. How very, very nice. Oh, gracious. Well, this has been like a great, great episode. I hope you both enjoyed talking a bit about these books, these comics. Matt, I saw your pictures here of your collection. Congratulations. It is flawless. I don't see a page out of just no bent pages, nothing. Everything's pristine. Good job.
Thank you. Yeah, I always took very good care of my stuff as a kid and as into adulthood.
Yeah, you and my husband have a lot in common. And I do not have a lot. I am the box cutter.
Someday I will cash out and retire to a private island.
Oh, invite me along. I need a drink.
I see no comment on my collection, which is riding loose and yellowing in the sun comparatively.
Oh, you're right. Yes, I see it now here. I also see the little panel that says believe it or else for Koopa pointing at you. It's very cute. I like that. But we did the best we could. I mean, like, my collection is far from pristine, too. It's certainly not complete, but I really enjoy talking about these comics because they are out there. So, yeah, thank you, everyone, for just kind of reading comics alongside us this beautiful summer afternoon. And that's what you do with summer afternoons. If you want to support Retronauts, and why wouldn't you? Go to Retronauts.com and sign up for our Patreon. And if you get the $3 level, you get episodes a week early and ad-free. A $5 pledge will get you two extra episodes in addition to all the other stuff and access to the Discord. And the magical Nintendo 64 number will get you the opportunity to set a topic of your very own. I can't remember if it's once every 3 months or once every six or four, but it's in that bracket somewhere. So, Daniel, why don't you go ahead and do you have anything you want to promote? Say hi.
I now work in fields where I'm not allowed to actually talk about what work I'm doing anymore. But you can find me on Blue Sky at DKASZOR, or I guess you could go to the same place on X.
X. Matt, how about you?
Of course, you can find all of my blogging work at pressthebuttons.com, where I've been writing since 2005. And also been podcasting since 2010 with the Power Button podcast, and all the old episodes of that show are there too. No ads. It's all free. Take as many as you want. Listen to them. Take you a long time, but it's well worth it.
I agree.
And you find me on social media as well. I'm on the app formerly known as Twitter, of course, at Press the Buttons. I'm on Blue Sky at Press the Buttons, and on Mastodon at the Press the Buttons Press the Buttons at myfi.social.
Something like that.
So getting used to how that one works.
Yeah, yeah. As for myself, I am also part of the Axe of the Blood God podcast. We talk about games, RPGs in particular, old, new, Eastern, Western. But if you want to support us over on Patreon, we are at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. We have a whole bunch of tiers you can sign up for. We talk a whole bunch about RPGs, a whole bunch about Final Fantasy XIV on Charlie and Dropouts, which is my other podcast. It is a Final Fantasy podcast. Blah. So, I hope you all enjoyed this. Until next time, thanks for listening. And if Tatanga pops out of your Game Boy, you'd best just trip along with it.